Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is Marcus from Gen Con TV, and we are back with a new episode of Fireside with Peter Adkisson, where the founder of Wizards of the Coast himself takes us on a trip through the untold history of Dungeons & Dragons with special guests from the game's illustrious past. In today's episode, Peter and co-host Emma Larkins are joined by former brand manager at Wizards of the Coast, Ryan Dancy. So without further ado, we'll drop you right into the conversation.
Hi there, welcome to Fireside with Peter Adkisson here on Gen Con TV, streaming live from Caldea Studios. My host today is Peter Adkisson. I'm Peter Adkisson. My co-host is Emma Larkins, and our guest today is Ryan Dancy. As you know, on this show, we go in search of the untold stories behind your favorite games, and we are covering Dungeons & Dragons now. And our guest today has a lot of great stories. His whole life is a great story. He was very central to the whole deal between Wizards and TSR and getting bought, and you're going to hear it live from Ryan today, right now. Ryan, woohoo! Thanks for coming.
Glad to be here. Super excited.
seriously, I really, really appreciate you coming down. Yeah. So I always like to start with a little bit of, like, who were you before Wizards of the Coast, before... I almost said Magic the Gathering, but yeah, before Magic the Gathering. I mean, I think I met you at DreamCon in what, 1993?
Yeah, just before Magic, probably 92 or 93.
92, yeah. Magic. Yeah.
We knew each other before Magic because you were going around to local conventions selling Primal Order.
Yes, yeah. I was. Yes, Wizards of the Coast first product.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Primal Order.
Everybody in Washington State had a copy.
Yes. And both my friends.
It was the new hotness.
Yes, the new hotness. Yes. So I met you there, and you had an ISP company. Yep. Is that right? Tell us.
I was fortunate enough to co-found one of the first regional internet service providers in the nation. Kind of on accident. A lot of my life is like, we started off to do one thing, and then an accident occurred, and then that turned out to be great. So we formed a company called Isomedia, and it was a regional ISP, and that kind of got us our fingers into a whole bunch of pies, just kind of helping people move big files around and connectivity and that kind of Wild West stage, early 90s, when, you know, the internet was something people didn't really understand.
I'm trying to remember, like, what was an ISP? This is before you just plugged into the
internet.
Yeah, that's right.
Internet service provider.
Yeah, right? That's right. Yeah, you had to pay somebody to, on your modem, call up to connect to get on the internet.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then that somehow you got into mail order through that, right?
Yeah. At the time I had a small child at home, and we wanted to restart our D&D campaign because that's something you can do when you have a baby. Like, baby sits in the crib, everybody plays D&D. And we were really poor, and we didn't want to pay full price for our products, our gaming products, because we had to rebuy all our libraries. Everything had gotten lost or misplaced down through the years. And we formed a fake mail order company so we could pay wholesale prices. And it turned out that there was a need for that company, and we started to get a lot of orders. And our fake mail order company turned out to be a real, which has nothing to do with providing internet service to anybody.
Right. So it was all on the up and up retroactively.
That's right. In the end, it all worked out great. Yeah, that's right. There was a local distributor here who I have very fond memories of, who kind of looked at us and thought, I don't know what this is, but it's probably harmless. And it all worked out really well.
Right. So somehow you got from there into, I knew you. You were out there. I'd always had a great impression of you. There was a part of me that always was hoping that we would work together somehow, somewhere, sometime.
Hmm. Yep.
But you ended up working with John Zinser, our good friend, who runs AEG.
Yeah, that's right. We, through a whole series of events that are probably outside the scope of this conversation, we ended up publishing a trading card game called Legend of the Five Rings, L5R. And that game was a door that opened to the whole world of hobby gaming for me. John was already there. He was publishing a thing called Shadus Magazine.
Right.
And in the process of making that game and then making a company to publish that game called Five Rings Publishing Group, we hired a guy named Bob Abramowitz, who weirdly, coincidentally, had worked for TSR as like a 20-year-old, and he knew the owner of TSR.
Yeah, but before we get to that, you hired him to help you raise money.
That's right,
To do Legend of the Five Rings, to publish L5R.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we managed to publish the first print run of L5R on the backs of, you know, friends and family money.
Yes.
My parents mortgaged their house, so we could publish that game. And one of my business partners at the time, Bruce, he cashed in a bunch of stock in Costco. And, you know, we got her done. But it was famously, I am known to have been under my desk at certain points with my head in the waste can, like the stress level. I wasn't always gray-haired. Like, the stress level was very high. But we got the first print run done, and we needed to raise more capital. You know, trading card games are a very capital-intensive business. It costs a lot of money to print, and you have to pay up front. Right. And yeah, so we had tried to raise cash, and we just were having a really hard time. And we, through a very series of connections, we met this guy named Bob. And Bob, well-connected in the Seattle area, knew a lot of people with money to invest. And he made it happen. He was a rainmaker.
So he went out and helped you raise a bunch of money.
$750,000 was the initial investment.
I mean, that's good money a hobby game publishing
and a bunch of
company.
Dudes no track record. Nothing we could point. No, not today. You or I could probably go raise money, but boy... then there's nothing, right?
I have a saying, there's no such thing as easy money. Yeah, I know, you probably meet the same guys. I meet CEOs, who entrepreneurs, who say, I never spend more than a week raising money. And they're like, it was never like that for me.
No, me neither.
It's hard.
I have a lot of skills. That turns out to not be one of them.
It's hard.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
Super hard. Yeah.
Okay, so... so how did that go after that? How far did that $750,000 take you?
Yeah, well, it didn't take us very far. So, so we had a very aggressive plan, and our plan was to have Peter buy our company. So what we wanted,
which I knew nothing about this plan, of course.
What we wanted to do was we wanted to make a series of trading card games that were loosely using the same model that Legend of the Five Rings used. They were factionalized. They would have stories. So we kind of thought we'd solved for that CCG segment, right? We could replicate it. So the idea was, we're going to make a bunch of these games really quickly. We're going to grow them all to be about the same size as L5R. We're going to be such an attractive acquisition target that Wizards is just going to say, we have to have you.
It's so weird to hear that our strategy, to hear my name attached to another company's strategy like that.
Well, better to have me say, and we wanted you to buy us rather than me to be saying, and we figured out a way to screw Wizards and we were going to buy them. It was not that way.
Right.
So Bob famously told John and I am going to run this company at the cliff as fast as I can. And your job is to figure out how to build wings before we die. he was super aggressive and wanted to move very quickly. And that was the right strategy, right? I mean, I think given that time and that environment. And so we just put the pedal down and ran at that cliff. Right. Meanwhile, John and I are, trying to make stuff happen. So I was responsible for the product design. So I had all these teams building games. John was doing sales and marketing. So he was traveling the country, talking to distributors and retailers. And every day that, that cliff got closer and closer. And we went to the Gamma Trade Show in 1996, which was in Reno. Okay. And that was a bad year for the gaming industry. A lot of small publishers had failed or were failing. And this weird thing happened. TSR, which had not missed a print deadline, they hadn't failed to produce a product on time in a long time.
They were famous for hitting schedules.
They were
they were well known for that.
They were a clock. They missed a bunch of print deadlines. And there were people at that show walking around with black armbands to, commiserate about the death of the gaming industry. And that was, I think, when people really got their inkling that there was a real problem. Like, TSR was not a healthy company at that
point. So, TSR, Publishers of Dungeons & Dragons, obvious to most people, but you never know. How does this lead from near disaster, pending disaster, to opportunity?
Well, as you know, Peter, sometimes in business, when you're about to fail, the best strategy is to try to get even bigger. Bob's idea was, if TSR has some kind of problem, then they need help.
Right.
And the idea of packaging TSR and Five Rings Publishing together and selling that as a new deal in the Seattle investment community wasn't that bad an idea. We could take our company, which was worth X, and say, well, now it's worth, 10X, right? because we've created this opportunity right. to buy yeah. this really valuable asset.
When you pitch it to Peter, obviously.
That, well, that, that
Peter has no idea.
That's coming very soon. Mm. And clearly that was in the back of our minds from the beginning. Mm. Right. Peter has been in the role-playing game milieu for his whole creative life. Mm. And Wizards of the Coast at the time was the most successful company in hobby gaming. And it didn't take a brain surgeon to figure out there would be synergy, right? Yeah. Obviously.
Well, and I think I was probably known, you guys knew that I loved D&D.
That's right, yes. Mm. And I've heard in the past, although I don't think we've ever talked about this, that there were people at TSR who felt like Wizards was kind of a usurper, that respect should be paid, that like you guys had kind of come out of nowhere and had gone from zero to hero, and that TSR was the power of the industry, the most important company, and how dare these upstarts in Seattle,
sell more than they
right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, we know, from analysis that actually Games Workshop had become yeah. bigger than TSR right. before Wizards became bigger than Games Workshop or TSR. Right. So really, they should have been angry at Games Workshop, not at Wizards.
Yeah, but they're British.
That's right. It's invisible.
It's in England.
It was invisible.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of brings us full circle. Bob had this weird...
And that's the bizarre thing. Right. It's like, you didn't hire Bob because he is connected to TSR, had some
Nothing.
History with TSR and
no.
worked there.
No.
I mean, that wasn't... You guys weren't thinking about
no,
that,
not
right?
in the slightest. We had, just, well, when we did
he was just the money guy in Seattle.
That's right. When we yeah. put the yeah. Fire Rings publishing deal together, TSR, as far as we knew, was perfectly healthy.
Yeah.
Right.
There wasn't any...
Right.
It wasn't even an inkling
right.
they were having a problem.
Right.
So lottery ticket comes good. Turns out Bob has the ability to pick up the phone and call Lake Geneva,
right.
get Lorraine on the phone, get the right. owner of TSR on the phone and say, right. I want to come see you. And then we did. And what we found there was
okay.
mind-blowing.
Okay. So let's dive in. Take
yeah.
us through it,
oh,
step
gosh.
By step.
Yeah.
We don't want to miss any second of this.
The nitty-gritty, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, the surface level was that TSR had... had successfully navigated a number of challenges in the 80s and the 90s,
right.
and that they outwardly appeared to be very successful. They had kind of mastered the art of publishing novels. They had their successful role-playing game line. They had been pretty successful at going into the trading card game business. They made Spellfire and the Blood Wars and something else I'm probably forgetting. So if you didn't know anything else about it, you would think they were doing great, right? Well, when we got in there and got under the hood, what we discovered was that they had not been doing great for a number of years prior to the iceberg becoming visible.
Mm.
They had a very unique deal with Random House. And their deal was that they could ship Random House anything. And Random House would pay them.
And Random House was their distributor into the book trade.
That's right.
Right? Hmm. B. Dalton, Waldron
That's right.
Books,
That's right.
and back when books were sold in
That's right.
stores.
That's right. And,
yeah.
and the book
yeah.
trade business was a really big business.
It was like, yeah.
There were thousands
third of their
of
business, right?
That's right. Yeah. Every mall in America had a B. Dalton and usually had a B. Dalton and something else.
Right.
And then the big, like the Barnes & Nobles, they came along. Walden Books was mm-hmm. everywhere. There was a
right.
big business of books in like airports. And it was a huge
yeah.
business.
And all those books had Dungeons & Dragons. All those stores had Dungeons & Dragons.
That's right. And they had the novels.
And
TSR
and
was
the novels.
Really good at publishing novels. And a lot of those novels made the New York Times bestseller list.
Right.
Wow.
So Random House had this deal with TSR. TSR could basically ship them anything, and then Random House would pay them. And Random House would distribute that product to the bookstores. And the understanding was that if it didn't sell, eventually there would be a return, and then there would be an accounting, like some credits would be issued or something. Well, the book business at the time, and some people would probably argue still today, is kind of archaic and not really nimble, and they don't pay attention to a lot of things they probably should have. And Random House kind of let it get away with them. And they had, TSR had racked up an enormous liability that had never really been
right.
been accounted for.
Right.
Like, and eventually Random House discovered that and came down on TSR with, both feet and a ton of bricks.
And this was at the end of 96, I
yeah,
think that happened.
In that time
right?
frame, yeah, right.
Yeah.
So suddenly TSR is being told by their biggest distributor,
right,
we want you to pay us a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
Along the way, as their business had kind of been decaying, they had made a bunch of other deals. They sold their building and then leased it back. They had sold their warehouse and then leased it back. They had made a deal with a printer that was the became the exclusive printer for TSR. So they couldn't shop their print jobs around to try to get a better deal. They were locked into this kind of long-term deal. And they owed money to all of these people that they didn't have. And,
right.
and they couldn't have. They didn't have the money. And they had taken out a very sizable loan from a bank. And that loan was guaranteed with the copyrights to a number of the key D&D
right.
IP. And they had also used other parts of the D&D IP to secure loans, lines of credit, and some of their foreign distribution deals. So one of the things that we found is that if TSR had been forced into bankruptcy, in a bankruptcy court, those creditors would have claimed those copyrights and trademarks. Oh. And it wouldn't have been like one company had it all. It would have been some over here and some over here and some over here. And so putting that egg back together again after it had been scrambled would have been really hard.
Yeah.
Like hard to the point where it might not have been possible to publish Dungeons and Dragons without
right.
years of litigation yep. and deal making. And of course, all of these people probably would believe that they had the best part of it. So they would want a premium price.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that happen sometimes in a complicated financial meltdown.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Things get scattered and then it's tough to get them back together again, right?
Right.
Well, there was one way to fix this problem. And the answer to that question is Peter Atkinson.
The fixer.
So we came back.
But
from...
you tried before you called me. You tried to raise the money. Bob tried to raise the money locally.
Yeah, I'm sure Bob called around.
I mean, at some point the idea came that you guys were going to buy TSR.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, Bob is an aggressive guy who's always, you know, moving and shaking and making stuff happen.
Right.
He would love to have purchased
right.
TSR.
Right. Sure. Mm-hmm.
If he could have found a couple of Microsoft millionaires to.
Right.
To put together a package, he would have happily.
Right.
But,
right.
I mean, I don't think that lasted long.
Right.
Partly because TSR was in such disarray. Like, they needed help fast.
Mm. Right.
And we were not in good shape either.
Right.
Because we had been running at the cliff and preparing to throw ourselves off and hope we invented wings. And so we were in this weird position at Five Rings Publishing. We had succeeded with Legend of the Five Rings in a market where most trading card games were failing. And we needed to print more of it. And we had a bunch of games that were coming down our production pipeline that we thought were going to be successful, and we needed to print more. And our cash flow at the time was not sufficient to allow us to print all the stuff that we wanted to print. So after Bob had kind of circulated around the local community and kind of realized that that was going to be a longer, more difficult pitch than maybe
right.
otherwise, he famously called Peter and said, I need to borrow $1 million. And Peter said, I love you, Bob, but that can't happen. And Bob said, I'm going to send you a fax, and then you're going to call me back, and we're going to talk about it. And the fax that Bob sent Peter was basically the cover letter of our letter of intent to buy TSR. And Peter called back and said, let's talk.
Wow.
And it was at that point, I think, when the momentum of the deal changed in ways that I don't think anybody at TSR really understood, because you guys definitely had the financial horsepower to do a deal. By far, you had the horsepower, but you personally were passionate about Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm.
It right. wasn't like going to Hasbro or Mattel or like it wasn't some clinical right. business deal. It was a thing you cared about,
right?
And I mean, your shareholders and your board were behind you. It wasn't like you were some out there in the wilderness.
Well, it wasn't. I mean, it wasn't like it was. I didn't have to pitch it and sell it. I mean, I had to go to the board, and if it wouldn't have been for, I mean, that's another story. But if it wouldn't have been for Richard Garfield saying, "Yeah, I think we should do this," he was he was on the board, and also Vince said, "Well, I don't know this game business, but Peter does, and he likes this, it was the board supported it. The biggest thing I had to fight was, why not just let this thing go into bankruptcy and buy it pennies on the dollar?
That's right. Mm.
Right.
That's
as opposed
right.
to paying, because the deal that eventually came involved us paying everybody off.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which in a typical bankruptcy,
you would never do.
You'd get it for,
a
quarter of that or something, right?
Yeah. 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 It was definitely a kind of a touch and go situation. And then, we had, part of our deal with Lorraine was, we were actually not supposed to shop this deal. We weren't supposed to tell anybody.
Right. Hmm. Right.
So this gets us back to what you were talking about before with, this kind of tension between TSR and Wizards of the Coast. There was a very delicate moment where Bob had to go into a room with Lorraine and be like, I need to tell you, Lorraine, that Peter Akison is going to be the funding source. And,
right.
you know, and I wasn't in that room, which is weird because I usually was, but that room I was not in. But, you know, Bob is a very persuasive guy, and he made it happen.
He was probably the perfect person to have that conversation with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was, he's like a specialized tool.
Well, and I remember I had a, I remember the conversation I had with you when I said, well, you know, if I'm going to finance buying TSR, then I want to buy TSR.
Yeah.
Like I'm not going to be a shareholder in your company. No offense,
that's right,
Ryan, but I'm not going to be a shareholder in your company and you're going to run TSR.
Yeah, no.
TSR is going to move to Renton.
That's right.
And be in the hallowed halls of Wizards of the Coast.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So then it became a roll up. It was, you know, buy TSR and buy Five Wings Publishing because we had the right to buy TSR.
Right.
So that was, that was, it was kind of a twofer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and I'll be honest, I mean, frankly, I was perfectly happy with that outcome. Like, I'd always wanted to work at Wizards of the Coast, and we were coming in as winners, so, you know, no harm done, right?
It was kind of an acquihire in a way, right?
It was an acquihire, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And it was a good acquihire. Like, everybody at Five Rings Publishing was happy to be a part of the Wizards family, and I think after some initial bumps, most of the people at Wizards were happy that they had ended up with us. Like, we did no harm. We made money worth the cost of our acquisition. It was okay.
Well, and I remember, you know, having a conversation with, I think it was Jeff Christensen, probably.
Probably.
About, you know, what is the, you know, we're going to pay these guys a lot of money. I'm not sure that
that would be a
the amount of money they're going to have get out of this is really, you know, and Jeff's like, in other deals, you'd pay an agent, that kind of money.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, you'd pay an agent.
Yeah, 10% or 10% something.
10% or something like that. Just think of it. That makes you feel better, Peter. Just think of it that way.
And
so, So we did the deal. We hired you.
Yep.
As we did the deal with Lorraine.
Yep.
Bought TSR.
Yep.
There obviously I'm glossing over what was
the hard part.
The 3 month process.
Yeah, that's right.
Going out and doing
a lot of
diligence,
late night phone calls,
a lot of meeting people, a lot of awkward meetings.
Flights to Lake Geneva.
Yeah, flights to Lake Geneva. Yeah. Going through, you know, I remember the, you know, the stacks of paperwork we had to sign for the deal.
Yeah.
And we hired you
to
be the brand manager for TSR, Dungeons & Dragons.
Kind yeah, of. So I came to Wizards and I worked in a group called New Brand Development and Licensing with Rich Fukutaki. And that's where we put, that's where Wizards put the Five Rings Publishing business. And I was, it was essentially a transition position at the beginning because I was managing those businesses. And in order to retain the value that Wizards just paid for, it would have been foolish to take me out of there. And I remember vividly, you came to my office one day and you said, I'm going to ask the board to put you in charge of the D&D business if you want to do it. And I was like, yeah, I totally want to do it. Like,
right.
Absolutely. I was just telling you the other day that when I was a kid, I told people, and I'm like 10 or 11 years old, I told people I was going to grow up to publish Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I made my own modules.
Yeah.
Like, it was the thing, right? Mm. And then it actually happened, which is crazy.
Yeah.
But I could have easily gone into Wizards and worked in NBDNL and made trading card games. And the original structure that Peter had set up during the transition could have managed the D&D business. And I would have just been a part of Wizards, but not a part of D&D. But eventually, Sir Ryan and put me in the seat.
Well, you know, it's a unique business.
Yeah.
First of all, and you'd studied it.
Yeah.
You'd studied it as someone who wanted to buy it.
Yeah.
You'd analyzed it as the type of analysis you'd want a business manager to do. Yeah. And you knew what the problems were.
Yeah.
I mean, we were confident that this business had value, but it was heavily in debt. So, okay, well, write a bunch of checks and get the debt off the books and then finance operations. How do we really make this into a company? And I felt you had the right vision for that. So why don't you describe what that vision was?
So we had a meeting shortly after you asked me to take that position on, which I called the dirty diaper meeting. And that was a meeting that Vince chaired, and it was me and some of the financial analysis people, and Bill Slavisek was there, and Rick Ahrens was there.
Now, Bill Slavicek was one of the senior guys at TSR.
That's right. Mm. Essentially became the head of the RPG design group.
Became head of, yep.
Yeah. Yep. Rick Ahrens was hired in as a business management at one point, and then he kind of took over and did a bunch of other cool stuff.
Yeah. By then, Rick was running organized play for Magic the Gathering, and now he's he runs Pokemon USA. Yep. I mean,
So the Dirty Diaper meeting was every part of this business is losing money. It's all broken. Revenues are down across the line. Costs are up across the line. It's cost of living in Seattle area much higher than Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. We just moved a bunch of folks out.
Yeah.
You know, partners are wondering what it is we're doing with this business. Industry is wondering what we're doing with this business. You know, are role-playing games even relevant anymore? And we kind of rolled up our sleeves and said, yeah, we can fix this. Like, this business is fundamentally sound. It has an amazing brand.
Right.
Great products. It has a 25-year, it was the silver anniversary, 25-year legacy of customers and products people are familiar with. We had strong video game licensing. We just talked about that earlier a little bit, about the relationships that had kind of been come into existence slightly before the deal, but Wizards of the Coast was managing them. So our goal was streamline the company, streamline the parts of TSR that Wizards had acquired to focus on the parts that were profitable. And that meant focusing on Dungeons & Dragons. Wizards had acquired a company that was publishing the Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game, the Alternity role-playing game, the Saga system, the Marvel Superheroes game. I think there were probably two or three other things in there somewhere.
Right, right.
All of which were surrounded by a penumbra of accessories, expansions, adventure content.
Right.
And we were basically offering to the role player, you know, a smorgasbord of choices. And there was something in every one of those choices that people liked. And so they were dividing their dollars and their playtime across this incredibly diffuse offering.
Yeah.
And that's bad in role-playing games. Because the most important thing about a role-playing game is having a group to play with. Hmm. And if you have five different people, all of who want to play a different game, it's really hard to get everybody to agree on what we're going to play when we gather for our game night, right?
Yeah.
So my business team, I was blessed to have a mixed group of people who had come from TSR and people who had already been at Wizards of the Coast that we kind of synergized together. We did a great...
Is it fair to say Lisa was...
Absolutely.
Lisa Stevens was on your team.
100%, yeah.
Keith Strom was on your team.
Yep. Dave Wise, Jim Butler, Cindy Rice. Anthony
good
Volterra.
Yeah.
Leeds Chamberlain was kind of our office manager. And that was just my business management team.
Right.
So one of the things that happened relatively early on was that Bill Slavicek had become the head of RPG R&D.
Right.
And he and I made an agreement. And the agreement was that my team would not interfere in creative decisions and his team would not interfere in business decisions. And that if my team had a problem with a creative issue or if his team had a problem with a business issue, that he and I would resolve that issue together. And I will say, Bill's one of the best partners that I've ever had in a business. Like,
that's great.
We had a super open and honest relationship.
That's awesome. I don't think he liked me much.
You know, I don't think that's true. I mean, Bill's a hard guy to read. And I'm sure we'll get into some of the third edition development issues, which there were passions and interested tempers in that, but
right.
No, I think Bill has nothing.
So you came up with this vision for like, let's really focus on D&D.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's funny because just last week Jonathan Tweet was on the show, and I think it was probably shortly after that he came in and pitched doing a Gamma World.
Yeah,
he said Ryan dashed my plans of doing a Gamma World, but then he said, but it was a good. He agreed with the decision.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah. It was one of those things where if we the business was broken. So it's really hard to change large established institutional entities like the role-playing game business at TSR. It's really hard. And about the only time you can make change is when there has been a massive radical dysfunction. Mm.
Right.
So the business was so broken that we were free to do heretical things like not publish a successful role-playing game like Alternity, or to not accept a proposal from a successful designer like Jonathan Tweet.
Right.
And Jonathan wasn't the only one. Chris Pramus had ideas he wanted to do. Rich Baker had ideas they wanted to do. There was plenty of ideas.
Yeah.
Right. And none of those were bad. They just were bad for that business at that time under those conditions.
Right.
So we had a thing we called the Nifty 50, which was the 50 best-selling SKUs in the TSR catalog. And they were all core D&D SKUs, except for a couple of Forgotten Realms things, and I think two Greyhawk SKUs, and then the two alternative books, the two alternative core books. And that we rebuilt the business of second edition around the Nifty 50. And we were able to get that part of the business profitable relatively quickly. One of the ways we did that was we stopped making a bunch of things that turned out were not making any money. So there was this thing at TSR where the creative people were kind of left to their own devices, and the financial people never really talked about any of the business of TSR with the creative people. And Lorraine and the executives at TSR, they were always pushing the creative people, like, do cooler things, do, you know, let's try something amazing. So they were producing a campaign setting called Planescape. Right. And Planescape was beautifully produced. Yep. It used a special printing technique, so the paper, the pages of the books had like metallic inks on them, a lot of full color maps and arts and inserts.
Especially for its time, was 95 absolutely or something beautiful, like that. Right? Yeah. Brom did the art.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff.
Right? I mean, this all happened before the acquisition.
That's
kind of recently to the acquisition.
Yeah, that's right. Right. And that game lost, I think, $3 every time we sold a copy of it.
What?
The core box. It's pretty easy to say, just don't make that anymore. We need to fix this business.
Yeah.
Let's just stop making the things that are losing money. But, you know, every time you do that, there's a plus and a minus. So there were people who loved that campaign setting.
Yeah. I was going to ask, it's obviously a very good business decision, but was there any feedback from the fans, from the people? What was the reaction when you started doing this?
Well,
moral outrage.
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is that TSR did not have a market research function that worked. They didn't know very much about their own customers. Mm. And they had some very weird policies about the use of the internet and interaction with people on the internet. So they were kind of deaf, right? And that carried over to Wizards of the Coast. Wizards did have a pretty good market research capability, and it did listen to its customers. But we were taking in that TSR system. And so until all the pieces were kind of connected, we were a little bit operating in the dark. But the stakeholders inside the company had very strong opinions. and a lot of these people, if you imagine that you worked at a company like TSR, like you got your job, you're going to work in the role-playing game business at TSR. Right, it's like, you know, being hired to work on an Avengers movie.
Yeah. Right.
If you're a comic book fan, and you get to TSR and then you get into a long queue of people who all have amazing ideas, and yours is one of the ideas that gets selected to become a campaign setting.
Right.
Like, it's epic. And then some dude comes in and says, nah, we're not going to make it anymore. It costs us $3 a box. We're just done with it. It has got to be one of the most difficult things to, as a creative person, to suffer through. And
it's coming from outsiders.
Outsiders. They didn't know. And anyway. Right. And I will say, like, if you could take Ryan and move back in time, the farther back in time you go, the more of an asshole I become. So, I was young and I was very arrogant and I was a difficult person to be around, and they had to put up with that. But okay, so yes, there was pushback, but at the end of the day, look, we had a job to do. That was to make that business function, and in order to become successful and go into the future and do cool stuff, we had to stop that bleeding. And I think we did, right? We did stop that bleeding.
Yep.
And then the next thing was, following easily from the idea of focusing on D&D, we have to make the next edition of Dungeons & Dragons.
Right.
And that edition of Dungeons & Dragons has to be the centerpiece of the renaissance of the role-playing game business at Wizards of the Coast. Like, that must work. We can't say, well, we'll do third edition of D&D, and if that doesn't work, well, then we'll try this other thing, and then we'll try... It was all in. Like, it was third edition or bust. It just had to work, right? And I mean, that kind of takes us up to your involvement in the design team and documents circulating and debates about direction.
Well, I remember I had to come in at one point and tell you, okay, Ryan, and I think I did it. You can verify this as true or not, or if it's just my memory, but I think it's at the time I gave you the job.
Yeah.
I said, listen, you want to run D&D? Great. I got to tell you up front, I'm running a design of third edition.
Yep.
So you're running D&D, but this is a very important part. I want all these designers reporting directly to me, and we're going to work on that. So it had to have been a little nerve-wracking to be in charge of this business, realizing what you just said about how important third edition would be,
yeah,
and not having any authority, and Bill Slavicek not really having any, yep, authority, neither one of you, yep, having real authority over, yep, it.
Right.
All those guys technically reported to Bill, yep, but in the context of the design group, yep, they reported to me.
And, you know, down the hall was Mary Kirchhoff, who's running the book business, which also had the magazine business.
Right.
And she's a strong-willed, independent woman, and she wasn't real interested in having me be her boss, and I wasn't her boss.
Right.
So, and the book business was critical to D&D, so that had to be managed. And then the convention business was being run by Susan Scheid, mm-hmm, and that was Gen Con. And, yep, you know, major decisions were being made about moving that to Indianapolis. I had to be, my role in all of this was to be the person who figured out how to make a strategy and then other people to follow that strategy, as opposed to telling people, this is what the strategy is and you must obey. Mm. Like, it was, I had to be very diplomatic and I had to figure out who needed to approve what and, you know, like, how far could I push certain things? And I mean, there was probably certain areas of my authority that I never tested. Like, there were things I probably could have done that I felt like if I did them, it would be catastrophically bad. I mean, there's certainly some things with Gen Con, for example, I probably could have gone in and banged my fist on the table and who knows what would have happened. And with Dragon Magazine, I remember vividly, we had a conversation at one point. An issue of Dragon Magazine had come out, and there was a piece of cover art on it. And, you know, for its time, Wizards of the Coast was very progressive in its depiction of women and non-white characters. Like, you set the tone. Mm. Then that was throughout the whole company. Like, we are not, we're going to break free of these old.
Well, and you can't credit me for that without me turning around and crediting Beverly, of course. Beverly
Marshall
Sailing.
Yes.
She really is the one who taught, yeah, me all,
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So a piece of cover art came across, and it made its way into a executive meeting, one of the Monday morning meetings. And I think either you or Vince turned to me and said, why did you let that happen? And I was like, well, I don't exactly have control of that, but I probably could have. Like, I could have.
Wow, I'm suddenly curious what that art was.
it wasn't that bad, but it wasn't what I would... I don't think you or I would look at it today and think it was acceptable.
Hmm. Right. Okay.
Right. Right. It was a little cheesecakey.
Yeah. All, yeah, right. Yeah.
And then we had confidence in your third edition development group because we were in that loop. We were getting the playtest materials. We were participating in the play. And when I say we, I mean my whole business team.
Right.
Everybody was engaged.
Sure. Sure. Sure.
So it wasn't like it was being done off-site in a black box.
And the WotC R&D people, the Magic R&D people, mm, you know, people like Scaff and Andrew Finch, I was playing with those guys.
That's right.
And it was being tested throughout the company.
That's
pretty
right.
I mean, it was a project that captured the imaginations, yeah, of everybody.
That's,
I mean,
right,
everybody felt cool. Like, yeah, wow, we have Dungeons & Dragons, yeah, and we have this opportunity. Yeah. And there was this balance of, yeah, we've, you know, of how do we apply our particular part of this and how do we respect the tradition and everybody is coming with it and get everybody to work together. It was, yeah, very tricky.
I mean, I think it was particularly easy for me in that I think your objective design aesthetic matched very closely with what I would have wanted to do anyway. I never ever felt like you and I were at loggerheads on anything involving, yeah, the design, yeah, ever. Mm. So, yeah, like, you wanted to do something and I would be like, well, of course, like that. Yes, just do that. Like, that's fine. Yeah. And you know that in the lead up to when you kind of reorganized that team, some of the work on third edition that had been done at TSR prior to the acquisition was not that. They had some ideas of being more radical. And there were some ideas that were not what I would consider to be kind of mainstream D&D design. They had been working on D&D for a long time and they were interested in stretching and trying new things. And that was part of the tension with the TSR people on the third edition team was how do we navigate this desire to creatively challenge ourselves with Peter's desire to make the best version of D&D? Hmm. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and fair to say, you were happy with the results, D&D. D&D was sold
awesome.
Well.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, Vince... Yeah, Vince.
Vince Glory, who was Vince Glory, my number two, yeah, and he was on the show last
exactly.
year.
Yeah. He very publicly. I'm trying not to use the expletives we were talking about before. his commandment to me was, you know, figure out what went wrong, fix it, and don't bleep it up. Right. Like that. One of the nice things about Vince is very clear direction.
Very clear direction. Yeah.
And so we got ourselves in a position where we had stabilized the company. We had a very good team. We had a very good expanded team, all the people that were, all the stakeholders were working on it. The third edition team was moving ahead in a direction that was virtually guaranteed to produce the product that we needed when we needed it. And that was when we started talking about the open gaming license.
Yeah.
That was
good.
The
good transition. I was just about ready to send you in that because yeah. Where we're at on the clock, I want to spend some time on the OGL because that, you know, that
yeah
was a
crazy
talk. I mean, it's a big move. So let's remind everybody what life was like before OGL and what OGL meant and did.
So
open gaming license.
The operating legal theory in the role-playing game business, which may or may not be true, is that you cannot publish a game that is compatible with somebody else's role-playing game system without a license. And that theory was used to box every game into a little silo. The publisher and a select group of licensors could make content for that game and nobody else. And so the gaming industry was filled with these silos. There was a White Wolf silo and a FASA silo and a Steve Jackson silo and a TSR silo. And as the total number of people that were playing role-playing games was shrinking, those silos were segmenting the audience into groups of people that were becoming disconnected. And that was causing gaming groups to break down, and that was causing a feedback loop where the whole role-playing business was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So we were looking around for models of ways to kind of break free of that. Wizards had a pioneering effort in that direction very early on, back in the Primal Order days, called Paragon?
Envoy.
Envoy, yes.
Well, and Primal Order itself, to be fair.
That's right, which was a cap system, a game that was designed to be used with many.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And we got sued for it.
And we got sued, yes. There's a gold sticker on the back of my copy of Primal Order.
Yes, yes.
Anyway.
Yes, it was compatible with 20 different Rs.
That's
RP,
right.
You know, MERPs, you know, Rollmaster, Ars Magica, all sorts of systems.
Yep. So our thought was,
we're lucky.
We're
lucky we only got sued once.
Right.
Oh, anyway, sorry.
So our thought was, what if we created an environment where anybody who wanted to could make content for the new edition of Dungeons and Dragons?
Right.
But we just wouldn't let them call what they were making Dungeons and Dragons. Like, we would be the people who published Dungeons and Dragons, but other people could publish content that was compatible with Dungeons and Dragons. Well, we know that if we said, oh, we're going to have this thing where you can say you're compatible with Dungeons and Dragons, that it would say compatible with Dungeons and Dragons, right? Mm-hmm. It would be, the obvious thing would be to confuse people about how the trademark
worked. Yeah.
So in addition to the idea of the open gaming license, which was the legal mechanism to let people make stuff compatible.
And I just want to emphasize, before this, you couldn't publish Dungeons & Dragons material.
You would be sued.
There were people that kind of skirted the edges, like Judges Guild stuff and so on.
But the role aids.
But basically, you couldn't do it.
Yeah, you certainly couldn't raise money to do it, because no investor would accept the risk that you would vanish in a puff of litigation, right?
Right. So
we created a intermediate brand, the D20 system trademark.
D20.
And we put the D20 system trademark on all the D&D books, and then we created a license that let publishers use the D20 system trademark on their products. And that created a linkage so that we didn't have to let people say they were using the Dungeons & Dragons trademark. Hmm. They could use this D20 system trademark. Well, okay.
And they wouldn't have to apply. They
that's
could
right.
just do it.
They could just do it.
We couldn't tell them no.
No,
and they
right.
wouldn't have to pay you.
There
and
was
they
no
money. There's no royalties.
Hmm. Yeah.
And et cetera.
That's right.
And I think there's a version of this is still around, right?
People publish under it all. Pathfinder's published under that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, So we knew going into the transition from second to third edition that our biggest competitor was Dungeons and Dragons. It was this huge library of second edition content and the older library of first edition content. And there was no way that our team at Wizards could possibly replicate all of that content in any kind of rational time frame, right? So if you were a person who really wanted to play a snake-headed ninja from a space world, we weren't going to get to you anytime soon, right? But if we uncorked the world to all those other publishers, somebody out there who had a bee in their bonnet to make, you know, snake-headed ninjas, they could produce that content, right?
Let's see, is this Chris Pramas?
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just making stuff up.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Right.
So essentially what we did was we thought, well, we're going to make the most valuable parts of the business, the nifty-50. We're going to make the player's handbooks and Dungeon Master's Guides and Monster Manuals. We're going to make the Forgotten Realms core books. But just like we're going to focus on just the stuff that we know is going to sell really well. Okay. And we're going to let the creative genius of the world fill in all the rest of the stuff. And they're going to do it, we thought, relatively quickly because like they've never been allowed to do it before. The desire that's built up over 25 years of you know, creativity in a bottle. And sure enough, it totally worked. Like, that stuff just came out of everywhere. It was awesome.
Like, Wolf jumped on it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was
Chris Pramas started his own company to do it.
Completely spun off it to do Green Ronin. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got an advanced copy of the first Creature Collection book, which was a collaboration between a company called Necromancer Studios, which was run by Clark Peterson, and White Wolf, which was run by Steve Wick and Mike Tinney and Steve's brother. And they sent me a copy of this book, and I walked around the Wizards of the Coast. I was like a father. Like, I wanted to hand out cigars. Like, White Wolf is publishing a D20 book. Like, how can anybody in this industry think that we're going to screw them if White Wolf is going to do it? Like, it was like a stamp of approval, right? And then we were off to the races. And it totally worked. Like, we sold the best part of the D&D business, the books that sold the most units, that's what Wizards of the Coast sold.
Right.
And we had the opportunity to look at all this cool stuff that was being created. And if we had chosen to, we could pick the pieces of that out and put that into D&D if we wanted to, because those rights were available to us as well as they were available to the rest of the world. Like, we could use that content. So
the snake ninja could show
it
up.
Could happen,
yeah,
right?
Still holding out.
It could be a big feedback loop. And then I think the next thing that we did that really shocked people was we said, this isn't just for fantasy role playing. We did the Call of Cthulhu game.
Right.
We did the Star Wars game. Like, we showed people you could take these core game mechanics and you could do any kind of game, any kind of genre. And because they were all kind of connected to some very fundamental parts of the game design, they were reasonably compatible. Like, it wasn't 100% compatible, but it really wasn't that hard. You could take stuff that we published for D&D and put it in a Call of Cthulhu game, a D20 Call of Cthulhu game, and it would basically work, which was awesome. And then at the same time, we were experimenting. So the Star Wars game has a different kind of critical hit system. It has wounds and, like, it has a more complicated thing about what happens if your character gets damaged, which is probably not appropriate for D&D, but that's one of the first things that designers do in D&D when they start making their own stuff, is they make these very complicated, you know, how does my arm get cut off? And how do I get a scar? Right? Well, you could, if you wanted to, you could just take that part of the D20 Star Wars game and put that in your D&D game, and all of a sudden you'd have this really cool wound system.
Yeah, I remember my Star Wars, I playtested in the Star Wars game. Hmm. I had an Ewok rogue character class, Ewok race, with proficiencies right out of third edition.
Yep.
I had two weapon fighting, so of course, two laser blasts.
That's right.
Boom, boom, boom,
that's
boom, right. Boom. It was great. It was gross.
Yep. Now, when we had told people, well, we're gonna narrow down our focus to just D&D, and a bunch of these campaign settings are gonna go away, and we're gonna whatever. Okay, there was like the roar was like a four, right? Mm. When we told people we were gonna give away Dungeons and Dragons, whoo, I mean, the roar was like a 9.5. Like, there were people who came in the meetings red-faced, thinking that literally the world was going to end, that we were about to make the most colossal business mistake.
People at Wizards.
Inside Wizards of the Coast.
Like, like a happy roar, like a mad roar. Oh, wow,
like,
okay.
What are you people are insane. We just paid X millions of dollars to buy this property, and Ryan wants to just give it away for free with no approvals? I mean...
But I liked the idea.
Well, we were golden because of
that.
But
I mean, but also, but I relied on people like Scaff and Richard, who must have been excited about it from the very beginning. But,
you know,
or Rick Ahrens, he understood network externalities.
That's right. I mean, we joked all the time about what I called the Scaff effect, which was if you had the market share leading game in any significant game category and the total amount of activity in that category increased, you would benefit. Hmm. Like, if more people were doing role-playing, Dungeons & Dragons, which was the market share leading game, would benefit, right?
Yeah.
So there was a business rationale to say, let's just get more activity in this space, and let's get that activity in games that are close enough to D&D that people's gaming groups don't get dissolved. Like, right. we could play Call of Cthulhu, and then we'll play the space ninja game, and then we'll play D&D, and everybody can kind of follow along, because we're not asking you to start over from scratch and learn a whole new game, and it totally worked, right?
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah, I mean, we had, when we did the first print run of the Player's Handbook for 3rd edition, there was a number that the sales team had come back with, and that number was too low, and Keith Strom, who was the person who was responsible for the business part of D&D, he increased that number and didn't tell me. And then that number was too low, and I increased that number again, and we didn't tell Peter. And we sold that in a month. It was gone.
Yeah.
And it shocked everybody how well 3rd edition was selling, because you could compare it to what 2nd edition had been selling before we released 3rd edition, right?
Yeah.
But I had a secret, and the secret was that I had this chart, which I still have, of data that we got from TSR during the due diligence, and I knew what happened in the year that the transition from 1st edition to 2nd edition had occurred. And it wasn't a percentage increase, it was a multiple increase, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, that is gonna happen. We're gonna get that effect. We're gonna go from whatever that 2nd edition number was, 20,000 copies, to this much bigger number. And then it happened. Like, it actually did that, right? Mm. So although I feel like the analysis was very good and my team did an amazing job of pulling all the facts and figures together, and Peter's team did a great job of building the game we needed to have, we were not as far out on the horizon as people might have thought we were. Like, there was some reasonable basis to the decisions that we were making. Hmm. Although from the outside, it looked like it was insane.
Well, also, like you had mentioned, everyone at the company was players, not just excited about it now, but had been playing it for years. Like, when you were seeing the splintering of the groups, you were seeing that in your own groups.
We absolutely did.
So it's all right in your face.
Yep.
Everybody had worked on Magic. It started with D&D.
Yeah.
I mean, Richard loved D&D. Scaff had played D&D. All these guys have played D&D. We all grew up playing D&D. And D&D influenced Magic the Gathering. So looking back now.
Yeah.
20 years later. Yeah. How long did you stay at Wizards?
My last day at Wizards of the Coast was September 11,
2001. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so you lasted a few months longer than I did.
Yeah, not much.
Yeah.
I mean, I was out of the role-playing game business that fall.
Weirdly.
Story for another time.
So looking back 18 years ago, you know, I don't know. I get goosebumps when I think about those days.
Yeah.
Like, how do you process it? Like, now that it's 20 years later, what do you think of when you think back to those days now?
Yeah. It was the single most fulfilling thing that I've ever done in my entire life. And I did it with a group of people that I love, and I was fortunate enough to do it at a time and in a company that was supportive of what we wanted to do. And so it wasn't traumatic. It was hard, but it wasn't painful in the sense it can sometimes be, right? I've never experienced anything like it. I don't think I ever will experience anything like it. And I'm so fortunate to have been given that opportunity. And, you know, I'm so thankful that this whole crazy series of coincidences that had to align in just a very specific way did. Yeah. And I got to do that thing and be in that place with those people. And it's amazing.
You say that you feel so glad that you were given that opportunity. I hope you know how glad I feel that you gave me the opportunity too. I mean, like, let's be real, it was a huge opportunity for me. It was a dream come true. You know, I'm glad that I was part of your strategic plan.
Yeah.
So my name was top of mind.
That's right. Just identify the best people available and go work with them. That's the secret.
It was what a privilege it was to work on that game.
Look, I feel like we changed the world in some ways. Like in this little speck of what we do,
right.
We found the lever and we moved the world. And you just don't get to say that very often. I mean, you've had the fortune. You did it with Magic, and you did it with D&D, and you did it with Pokemon. Like, you've had that experience multiple times. Like, I had experience once.
Well,
and
you
most
know,
people with, never have.
I mean, with Magic, I feel like I just got lucky. You know, I mean, I met Richard. I mean, okay, I was a nice guy, and Richard, you know, liked me. We got along, and you know, he's the one that, you know, designed it. It was like, wow, just got this gift. You know, and Pokemon was the same sort of way. You know, but I felt a lot more connected. I felt like D&D, and I was like a chance for me to do something right, in a sense of like I was more like, yes, okay, let's go out and get this deal done, you know, let's go out and get this, buy this company and negotiate it and convince everybody it was good, you know. Certainly a lot of people thought we overpaid, but it was like your bankruptcy comment earlier. We wanted to keep the property intact, and that meant not buying it in bankruptcy.
That's
where
right.
you'd have, where we would have paid a quarter of the price.
Yeah.
It meant paying the full price.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and,
And look, a bunch of the stuff that you did during that acquisition was absolutely to your credit, like restoring Gary and Dave Arneson to their proper place. A lot of the artists received art that they didn't ever expect to see again. Mm. I mean, there were a lot of people who were associated with D&D who were made whole because Wizards bought the whole thing and didn't try to play games in bankruptcy court.
It was
pretty cool.
Good.
And can you imagine if D&D had gone away, you know, if just like if it had ended at that point and all through all the years.
I can't imagine it. It's the nightmare scenario. I spent a lot of nights looking at the ceiling thinking, if I screw this up, very careful to be family friendly, if I screw this up, like it's on me. Like, D&D could have died because of me.
You could have killed Dungeons &
Dragons. I could have killed
Dragons.
Dungeons & Dragons. Like, gray hair. Mm. Yeah.
So, we're almost out of time. So, catch us up. What's happened in the last 18 years?
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
So, I work with John again.
You're back with John Zinzer.
I know, it's crazy.
I knew that was the answer. I hope if he watches this, I hope. I love John.
Yeah.
John's, I don't see him
John's
as much
one of the
as I
best
like.
Guys in the gaming industry. I'm the chief operating officer at Alderac Entertainment Group, so I'm responsible for all the back office stuff. I also have a role in like filtering and picking new games before we publish them, and I run our Kickstarter process. So when we put a game on Kickstarter, I'm behind the scenes making that all work.
But I imagine your real value is that you're someone John can talk to about the business. You guys, I think it'd just be fun to be a fly on the wall and want some random Dave and you and John go at it, figuring out.
I mean, he and I are uniquely compatible. We have strengths and weaknesses to complement each other. And I think we've known that for a long time. So it's real pleasure to work with him in a formal, you know, he and I have worked together on and off for a long time, but really just be in the same organization is really good.
Right.
And I'm doing this streaming thing. So Luke Peterschmidt, who you know, and a guy named Will Kunkel that you don't. Every week we do a political stream. I've been a political junkie for a long time. I have no credentials, never run for office, but I'm just really interested in it. So we do that.
I always enjoy your posts on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. And then my wife is a successful attorney in Everett. I dragged her all around the world for over 15 years. And we came back to Seattle to do the Goblinworks deal with Paizo. And she set down roots and got her firm up and running. And I'm pleased to be able to support her. You know, it's my time to be her backstop. So it's pretty cool to watch her, you know, flourish and get all that stuff done. She sends her love, by the way.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Love to Lane.
Yeah. My daughter, you know, who was born a few years before Magic was released. And used to ride her hippity hop around Wizards of the Coast.
I remember her as a child riding her hippity hop.
Yeah, named after the character in Ringworld, the luckiest girl in the universe. She grew up and she's a nurse. She lives in California. So, like, success. Like, there's nothing I can point at in my life and say, well, that was a tragic error. And, you know, like, just so lucky and fortunate to have done so many cool things.
Right. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being on Fireside with us.
It was awesome.
It was great.
I had a great time.
I hope you enjoyed today's new episode of Fireside with Peter Adkisson. If you want to catch the show live, be sure to tune in every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific on twitch.tv/GenConTV. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to stay up to date on all the Fireside podcast happenings. We will be back every Monday with a classic episode of Fireside covering the history of Magic the Gathering, and every Friday with a new episode of Fireside Dungeons & Dragons. Again, I've been Marcus from GenConTV. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you soon.